Hi, this is Zoe Durand, and I'm a family lawyer and mediator, and you're listening to the Inside Family Law podcast. This podcast is presented by Mediation Answers in partnership with Artwork and Lawyer Magic. Over the course of these episodes, I will take you on a 360-degree deep dive into all aspects of the family law process by talking with some of the greatest minds in family. I'm hoping that through this podcast, we can really encourage interdisciplinary conversations and perspectives that allow us to go deeper into what is really going on in the family law process, and that also make us more curious in our approaches to family law and how we do what we do every day. Well, we are here live at the Pacifica Congress Conference in Hobart. Very exciting to be here. And I'm here with two of the facilitators. I'll let them introduce themselves.
Hi, Sally. Susan Water from Mills Oakley.
And Bernie Bulger from the Mediation Collective.
So I understand that you ladies both presented just today, just fresh an hour or two ago.
That's right.
What were you talking about?
We were talking about collaborative family law, and in particular, interdisciplinary practice of collaborative family law, so ICP.
And we were also explaining how ICP is actually a model of interest-based negotiation and putting some real theory around that.
Can you just to backtrack for those, because obviously some of the listeners will have been to the conference, some won't, but most of them usually are in family law or interested in family law. What is ICP exactly, like nuts and bolts in theory and also in practice?
So ICP stands for Interdisciplinary Collaborative Practice, and it's a form of alternative dispute resolution where you have both clients and their respective lawyers, and normally a neutral, what we call a coach.
Okay.
In New South Wales, that tends to be a mediator, come psychologist. We all gather together in a room, and we have a form of interest-based negotiation. So instead of one lawyer and their client advocating for that person's entitlements, we come together and we discuss their interests, their needs, their concerns, and as a team work out the best outcome for the family as a whole. And there are some legal implications for that, which I'm sure Susan will be able to go into in a bit more detail.
One of the main differences between ICP and other forms of dispute resolution, Zoe, is that the parties and their lawyers and anyone else you use in the team, whether it's a coach or a financial neutral, all sign a participation agreement. So essentially a contract from the outset. And one, whilst that contract regulates how the process will work and the expectations and obligations of everyone, there is also a very important section in the contract that says if the matter cannot be resolved and a solution can't be reached for these parties, or one of them decides to terminate the collaborative process, then the lawyers who are acting for them in the collaboration cannot act for them after that. So they need to engage new lawyers and start all over again if they terminate the collaboration, either one of them. If anyone terminates a collaboration, then they start with a new set of solicitors for both of them.
And how does it suit? I mean, I'll be honest with you, I'm familiar with collaborative, but not this ICP in terms of the interdisciplinary nature and the bringing in other professionals. It sounds really wonderful, actually, in my opinion, just subjectively. What are the roles of the non-lawyers? Like, for example, if there was a financial expert or a psychologist, like, are they meant to express opinions? Like, what's their role, you know what I mean, situated within it?
Well, if you think about it, when a family separates, you know, whatever that family may be, even though it's governed by the legalities of family court, it is probably one of the most traumatic emotional and financial episodes in a person's life, in a family's life. And it just doesn't just affect the parents, it also affects the kids. And so what we try to do in the collaborative process is actually deal with the emotionality and the emotions of the process as well. So of course you have to have your legal advice, But if it is that maybe in a family one person is more across the financials than the other, then we can bring in a financial expert who can help explain the financial positions of the actual family so that it levels the playing ground, it levels the field. Mm-hmm. Or if it might be that the kids of a certain age, that there might be a disagreement between the parents as to how the kids should spend their time, we can bring in a child expert who can talk to the kids and then give feedback to the parents to say, this is at, you know, this age, this probably is more suitable developmentally for the children, or they might need external help. So it literally is, it's not just about the legal entitlements of the family or the mum or the dad. We are looking at it holistically. And at the end of the day, these parents are going to be parents for life. And if we can actually come to an agreement whereby the parents can attend, you know, bar mitzvahs or communions or engagements or 16th birthday parties or weddings or graduations, isn't that better for everyone?
So I guess really looking at preserving the sort of relationships, preserving resources, if you're looking at financial resources. And it sounds like there's an aspect of, I guess, if there was one party that has less financial acumen, for example, they'll kind of get that third person to get advice from, which I think is quite useful, because I've seen a number of matters where one party does feel sort of disadvantaged and there's a lack of trust and they feel quite anxious, you know,
and when you have a financial neutral, they're working with each of them, but particularly helping that person that you've just described, the person who might not have managed the money, the person who's terrified about a financial future on their own because they've always thought they'd be together, they'd be looked after, that there'd be joint superannuation. And that role of education that the financial neutral often provides, as well as giving them comfort about how they can make their money work more effectively for them. Mm-hmm. And I always say to people, it's a process that lets you move on with decency and dignity. They're the words I always use because I think they're really fitting for where a couple finds themselves at the end of that process rather than the alternative processes.
And so how does it work just on the nitty-gritty? So, I mean, I know non-interdisciplinary kind of collaborative, when it's just both lawyers are collaboratively trained, there's usually multiple sessions. Is it the same with this process, or how does it work?
One of the really nice things about this is that it really, there's a transparency across all aspects of it, because even in your normal mediation setting, your lawyer will talk to your client and will hear that client's narrative and therefore will give legal advice based on that story, and that legal advice is privileged. And then in the other room, a similar story will be happening. But sometimes, and I work as a mediator as well, sometimes I talk to both clients and I think, these people have not lived on the same planet, let alone been in the same relationship. So from the lawyer's point of view, they can only give advice based on what they've heard.
Sure.
And therefore, that nearly sets it up for failure to a certain extent. Because even though no matter what a lawyer says to a client, as in, I can only give you a range, or there's no absolute outcome, you know, people tend to get anchored to the advice that they want to hear.
Yep.
But when you're in a collaborative process, and each lawyer hears from each client, My experience has been, when you've got two experienced lawyers in a room and they're both hearing the same story, their advice tends to be very similar. And because we have all signed a contract to act respectfully and not to make good on someone else's mistake or whatever it might be, that if there even is a difference of opinion between the lawyers, they can deal with it in a respectful manner.
Sure.
It's not we're not going to use someone's vulnerability against them. And that's what happens in a mediation.
Yep.
A lot of times in mediations today, it's a pre-step to court.
Yeah, like absolutely.
Even when we talk about position papers.
Yeah.
Like, there are no position papers in collaborative.
And now, just a couple of words about Lawyer Magic, a one-day course on the secret sauce to law practice scale-up. We demystify all the parts around being a lawyer that you actually need to know to thrive in law, but usually no one teaches you. The three pillars to lawyer magic are the law of attraction, being magnetic, branding, marketing, and positioning yourself as an expert, the honeymoon phase, drawing clients to you, networking, building referral chains, keeping the spark alive, keeping clients happy along the whole journey and getting paid seamlessly, but in a way that clients understand the value of your work. Nicole Evans said, Zoe and Roey were fantastic. They tailored this course around our firm and our needs. We all took away a lot of practical tips and new ideas to implement on a day-to-day basis. We believe the real magic happens by identifying what is naturally unique about you, including your special passions, and showing how to amplify and communicate this. Exhibit A, hopefully like I'm doing in this podcast. So how does it work? So just break down for me that how would, say it's a client wanting to do this process.
Yes.
How does it work? So they would find a lawyer who's, how does it all?
So the client would engage with their family lawyer. Mm-hmm. The lawyer might tell them about collaboration. Or the client may have contacted Bernie and spoken to Bernie about their separation, and Bernie will recommend, why don't you try collaboration as a way of resolving your family law dispute. So they can enter the dispute by being referred through different people.
Mm-hmm.
The trick, though, Zoe, is trying to then persuade the other spouse or their former partner to also commit to the process. So ideally what would happen is you would invite them to participate in collaboration. They will engage a lawyer who is collaboratively trained and encourage them to use that process. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they may already have seen a lawyer that isn't collaboratively trained, does not know enough about collaboration, or isn't confident in the collaboration process, because many lawyers get very concerned about the participation agreement and the risk that the case may not settle, which I'll add is, in my view, not something that commonly occurs. There is a very, very high success rate in collaborative matters resolving. There are very few matters that don't resolve, but I know that there are lawyers that don't feel confident enough with certain clients that they meet to refer them into that process, because they are concerned if the matter doesn't settle, then they
lose the client.
Stay in the matter.
And the way that I would address that is that I have done many collaborative matters at this stage, and it actually is a joyful way to work when you see two good, experienced lawyers in a room together. And I say to the family, isn't it far better off having both lawyers using their energy to work for the family as a whole and to get the best outcome from the family as a whole, rather than pitting their energy against each other in order to win? Because in order for one person to win, the other person has to lose. That's just the nature of family law. But in a collaborative matter, it is such a team effort. And to see good lawyers give good advice and actually understand that at the end of the day, the professionals are going to leave these people, leave their lives. They've got to go out and live their lives. And isn't it, you know, a legacy that we can actually leave the family in a place where they can actually be a separated family who respect each other and who actually value each other and their roles in each other's lives and their children's lives?
I mean, what you talk about sort of touches on something more deeper, or maybe even philosophical, about the way we practice law, the role of the adversarial system, how the adversarial process, and I'm not saying it's goodies or baddies, but just how the adversarial process can permeate things, even into sort of conventional mediation. You're right, sometimes it does feel more adversarial. So it's interesting what you're saying about how are we doing, different ways of doing family law, I suppose.
When collaborative was started in the 1990s in America, there was a family lawyer called Stu Webb. And what he realised was, if you actually take the threat of litigation out of negotiation, everyone is more incentivised to actually get a resolution. Mm-hmm. And that's, unfortunately, the way it's kind of set up, and I'm not a lawyer, and Susan could probably speak to this a bit more, but it's set up so that you do a mediation, a half-day mediation or a full-day mediation, and you come to, say, 3 o'clock, and if you're not getting a resolution...
I'll just go to court.
I'll just go to court. I'll see you in court.
Yep.
And you're setting it up for failure. Collaboration, it can sometimes, one of the people just needs a bit more time. And collaboration can do that. We can work with the slowest person. Some they need to process stuff. They need advice. They can do that. We have a series of meetings. They're only like 2 hours, 3 hours long. Stuff gets discussed. They can go away, think about it, but they know that they're coming back in 2 or 3 weeks' time.
And it sounds quite like they probably feel quite safe in the process, in that because you've all signed that contract. I mean, you know that it's kind of, there's a lot at stake to resolve it. It's not like there's going to be that threat, that shotgun threat, well, I'll just go to court. So they know they've got that kind of safety in the process.
That's right. And the contract also regulates their obligations. Disclosure obligations are exactly the same as any other traditional form of negotiation or dispute resolution. So they are still both expected to provide all of their documents, if there's additional material needed, if there's valuations that need to be obtained, if there's wishes of children that need to be obtained, then you might, in the interdisciplinary model, use someone to meet with the children and provide feedback so that the parents can make some decisions, taking on board the children's wishes, if that's appropriate, having regard to their ages. So that makes it easier to help the whole family when you can access other professionals to be able to achieve an outcome.
I really like this sort of involvement of the neutrals, as you know, with the in financials, but also, as you said, with psychologists or you know, experts who can meet with the children and bring, and I guess give feedback to the parents. So it's not just one lawyer or the other lawyer; it's someone else who's neutral giving some feedback, who's in, got expertise to do so,
knows how to talk to children in an age-appropriate way, but doesn't have any agenda, only making sure that the children are safe and secure in the relationships of both parents. And you're right, sometimes it feels a bit like magic, but in a role, I can say something, and I can say exactly the same as, say, the former wife or former partner has, but I'll be listened to because I don't come with the trauma or the baggage or the history of the relationship. And it's the same with a child inclusive practitioner. Most parents know, like deep down, they know what's going on, but they don't, when it's coming from the other parent, it just in
mistrust.
There's a mistrust or there's a different agenda. Having someone neutral talk on behalf of the kids gets listened to, and so it's, they've got credibility.
Mm-hmm. And now a few words about artwork, where we bring art to your place of work. As some of you might know, away from the law, I have pursued a passion for art, exhibiting in London, Sydney, Melbourne, throughout China, and at a contemporary show in the Louvre in Paris. I'm now sharing my love of art and creativity with workplaces. I'd love to hear from you if you would be interested in team bonding art lessons, curated pieces for your office, or making your next corporate event a showstopper with a piece of art created live for your guests. I'm also interested in any of the other ideas you might have about how to inject creativity into your place of work and shake things up, hopefully in a good way. The benefit of working with me is that uniquely I am both an artist and a lawyer, so I have an understanding of the law firm corporate events context and can chew the fat with your guests about law, life, art, and my creative process whilst I create your special piece for your firm. Bronwyn O'Lone said, "This was truly an amazing experience. We keep getting comments from those that joined us on our special evening about how inspiring it was to watch you create such beautiful art. The memories will live on in the artwork, which will be hung proudly in our meeting space." I mean, it's interesting when people talk about collaborative practice, and sorry, this is a bit more anecdotal or maybe a bit to the side. You know, there's the formal kind of collaborative process, but, you know, sometimes people talk about, like, I hear lawyers refer to, you know, collaborative practice or a collaborative approach, and, you know, it can be that old thing of, say, you pick up the phone and be able to speak to your other practitioner. I mean, that's not strictly collaborative law, but there's also, I think, something to be said for collaborative approaches, not necessarily formal collaborative law, even in how we're negotiating things and dealing with our co-practitioners. I don't know what your thoughts are about that.
I agree entirely, and I was saying to someone earlier today that a number of younger practitioners who might not yet be ready to run their own collaborative law matters are going and getting the training, because I think it's an important skill set for them to have in, as you say, collaborating with their opponents in other matters, whether it's a matter that they're negotiating by way of correspondence or going to court and then get sent to a dispute resolution event. They have those skills available to them to use.
I think what you're saying, though, as well, there are people who talk about working collaboratively rather than being in the formal collaborative.
It may not be a formal collaborative actual process, but
there is no reason why we cannot treat other professionals with respect. There is no reason why we need to demonise the other lawyer's client. But there is a definite difference between signing the participation agreement,
absolutely,
and that kind of keeps everyone honest and it keeps everyone on track. But absolutely, there are some cases that aren't suitable for collaboration, for the full collaboration. But that doesn't mean we don't have to act like respectful human beings. And I know I've been in matters where I will work with lawyers whom I would do collaborative matters with, and they're a joy to work with, And then I'll work with them as a mediator, and I think, oh my God, who are you? Like it's like they have got a personality transplant. I think, and that is not what mediation was ever supposed to be. Mediation is supposed to be a settlement process. Mm. It's not supposed to be an escalation of issues to end up in court. But somehow or other, it's gotten lost in translation, and at least with the collaborative, the formal collaborative process, we are all held to account, and we are all working from the same songbook. Mm-hmm. And that is really, it's really nice for the family.
What do you think? You mentioned there's really high settlement rates. Do you feel like, just anecdotally, I'm not holding you to it, do you feel like it's what, like 80%, 90%?
No, significantly higher than that.
Late 90s, okay. Late 97, 90s.
Very few cases that... For those of us who do a lot of collaborative law matters, if you make inquiries, and we did that to an extent during the session today, we would say high 90s.
That's truly amazing.
It is.
You know, that's kudos to you guys. That's exceptional, you know, outcomes.
And can I just add this for when I was saying earlier on that a number of lawyers are very nervous about signing the participation agreement, and that's why they may not encourage their client to participate in the process if their client's received an invitation to collaborate from their former spouse. I just want to say that those clients who I've had go through the collaborative family law process become the best ambassadors you can have, the best referrers, because they are so grateful for the work you've done for them, for their family, that they want other people they care about to have a similar experience. And I've watched that develop and happen with my own practice. So I hope that that little piece of information I'm sharing encourages more lawyers to commit their clients to a collaborative practice matter.
And I would say, and Susan, I know this has happened to Susan, I think the biggest accolade that a lawyer can have in a collaborative matter is when the client of the lawyer on the other side actually recommends friends of theirs to that lawyer. You know, so they from the opposite side, because they have been treated with, as Susan says, with dignity and decency. And so to actually say, this was a process where they knew we were a family, they listened to both of us, I felt respected, I felt like a human being, I felt that I was valued in this process. And so you're never going to recommend a lawyer who keeps you in court for 7 years. Like, that's the most traumatic.
Regardless of it being what the outcome is, even if the outcome was favourable, what they're left with is, I litigated for 7 years, I spent X amount of dollars, the process means I no longer can even speak to my former spouse at soccer on Saturday when we are both there with our son. And that's usually where a piece of litigation where you've both been cross-examined leaves you, doesn't it?
Yeah, so to have a process whereby, as I say, we leave this family, they have to go on, they have to continue on as co-parents, or even just as, like, I look at this as it's a transition piece. Why can't we honour the relationship that was while moving to the next phase of our lives, whether there are kids or there aren't kids? This was time in our lives, and let's honour it.
Well, look, thank you both, Bernie and Susan, for speaking with me. A link underneath this will have contact details for the Pacifica Congress and also for Bernie and Susan. Thank you very much for your generosity and sharing your knowledge.
Pleasure,
thanks,
Zoe.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Inside Family Law. I hope you got a lot out of it and that it has sparked a lot of questions and conversations that you'll keep having with your colleagues in the area. If you do want to stay connected with me, then please reach out on LinkedIn. You can find me, I'm Zoe Duran, or you can reach me on Instagram at Mediation Answers. My website is www.mediationanswers.com.au. If you have any fabulous ideas for a podcast interview, then please be in touch with me. Also, if you would like me to cover your family law conference, for example, or any other conference or event, I'm more than happy to discuss if this would work, so please also do reach out. Thanks very much, and I hope you listen in next time.